Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan, and I appreciate you being here. I finished up a conversation with Julian Figueroa and Isabella Santos recently and love this discussion. Isabella and Julian are very energetic, fun, have all sorts of cool and crazy stories about their time together working and traveling. And I think you're going to enjoy this one. I love the content that they're putting out. They are doing some amazing things for Bitcoin and making it really fun and interesting, I believe, for a new generation of Bitcoiners. So I hope you appreciate and enjoy this conversation with them as much as I did. All righty. Like I said in the intro, I've got Julian and Isabella. Isabella, Julian, welcome to the show.
What up, guys? Thanks. Thank you for having us.
I'm happy to have you guys here. Really appreciate the time. So let's start. We were talking right before we jumped on. You guys started working together before you'd even met in person, I think. Could you tell me that story? And I guess it was Julian that invited Isabella. And maybe what made you crazy enough to take the leap of faith?
So it all started with a DM. Well, actually, no. Let me go back. The 28th of July is the Peru Independence Day. And I had posted a picture with an alpaca from that year's trip to Cusco, or a last year trip that I had in Cusco. And I posted, like, I don't know, Peru needs Bitcoin for free. I don't even remember what I posted, but it had something to do, you know, with the Independence Day of Peru. I feel like Julian stumbled across this post, and then he DMs me like, hey, I saw you're Peruvian. I'm actually going to shoot a Peru doc in December or later on this year. Would you be down to come? Mind you, I had just quit my fiat job in March of that year. And I'm a journalist. I studied journalism, and I had always wanted to go out and help, especially help your own country shoot a documentary. Plus, it was about Bitcoin, and I'm into Bitcoin, love Bitcoin, had been, in the Bitcoin content creation space for about 2 years at that time. And I said, fuck it, why not? Let's do it. And being Hispanic, we always say yes to everything, you know, and last minute, you're like, oh, this came up, you know, I'm going to cancel. So I was like, you know what? I'm not going to shut any doors. You never know what happens. So I say, yes, let's do it. And fast forward a couple of months later, it would be like random DMs would be like, hey,
is this still happening?
We're like, yeah, let's do it. And the thing was, I didn't have that much. Well, I still don't have that much money to go out and travel the world. And I was like, bro, I can't afford a full flight, plus all the numerous flights that we're planning to do, because we were planning to do 5 cities plus the hotels. I'm jobless. Like, we need to figure out a way. And that's when you come in.
Yeah. And I have been selling way too much Bitcoin to make all the silly little videos that I make. And so this time I was like, I can't really afford to pay for myself, Isabella, and all the flights. So why don't we do a crowdfunding campaign, see what we can get? We start this one on Geyser Fund. And for those who don't know what Geyser Fund is, it is basically like Kickstarter, but it's more just Bitcoin focused.
Bitcoin focused.
And the settlement's right away. So it's like on Kickstarter, you got to wait like weeks or months before you get those funds. And that wouldn't work because we wanted to do this like, you know, in the next like 2 months. So we start this thing on Geyser Fund. To my shock, in the first 48 hours, we were like 50% funded. And I was like, okay, this is great. And I think the thing that helped with that campaign is that I made like very clear perks for it. So it was like, if you give us $50 and you buy this perk, we will go on site and donate $25 to someone and film it. And we did all that. And then also, if you want to see the rough cut early, you know, it's this much in Bitcoin. If you want to sponsor the video too, rather than me going out and finding sponsors, which I had no luck with,
We got rejected
over and
so
over.
So many times.
Yeah.
No, those big buck companies that, you know, we all support as Bitcoiners.
Yeah.
None of them wanted to help us. They did not see the vision.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So we said, okay, we'll just make amounts. And then if people want to sponsor it, they can just buy the perk and then they become a sponsor. And then it's like, you know, no shit coins, please. That's all.
Okay.
And all these like tiny Bitcoin companies, small mom-pop operations, or like max 10, 15 people on staff, all come together and they, you know, they sponsor here and there. And by end of November, about 2 weeks before we go to shoot, the thing is fully funded. We raised a quarter of a Bitcoin. Price of Bitcoin went up, you know, during that time too, which was great. And we did the whole doc completely crowdfunded by about 150 people total.
Wow.
Average donation about $40 worth of Bitcoin. And we took an 8-day romp around Peru. We were up in the Andes Mountains where the air is thin. You can hardly breathe. You're kind of turning loopy. And then we went down to Lima, the suburbs of Lima, Quebrada Verde, like a desert out there. And then we went to Tarapoto, Huanguera, which is like on the edge of the Amazon rainforest. It's a bit more mountainy there. And then deep to Iquitos, which is like the most, it's the biggest landlocked city in the world. There's no roads that go in there that connect any other place. And finished the video there in the Amazon rainforest. Very hot, very humid. But yeah, 8 days of traveling all around Peru, spending Bitcoin. And in the next 2 weeks, whenever this, you know, whenever this video comes out or this podcast, but May 15th, May 16th, the full documentary will be out, free to watch for everyone.
But I have to highlight. Cool. So people are going to think I'm crazy because my family thought I was crazy. My family's super old school and traditional. And I had told them, hey, I'm going to go to Peru, to the outskirts of Peru, to figure out how they're using Bitcoin. My family was like, excuse me? What do you mean they're using Bitcoin? Of course they're not using Bitcoin. They have no bank accounts. You're not going to go with the random guy you met on the internet. So people were, my family, all our conversations when we were in Peru were building up like, how are you going to go with this random person from Canada? Have you seen the crazy Canada cat guy that killed the cats for a living?
Wait, what? That's,
you've never seen the Canadian cat?
Oh,
Netflix,
yeah.
Netflix show?
The Canadian cat murderer?
Yeah.
Never heard of that.
Is it?
I've never seen it. I heard about it. He like started killing cats and filming it. And then he eventually started killing people, I think. It was like
crazy. Savage.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Canadians don't have the best rep.
Well, I'm not a fan of cats.
So. Yeah. But my family didn't know that. So they're like, what do you mean? Where are you going to sleep? You know, no one's going with you. And what happened was I was like, guys, I'm old enough. I'm going to make this happen. You know, like I don't rely on you guys to, you know, pay for my stuff. So this is happening. So fast forward to you were arriving the next day and my family was going back home. Because the thing was, I ended up being in Peru a week before Julian showed up because I was celebrating my grandma's birthday. So everything was lining up for me to go to Peru. And obviously having my family there kind of made me feel safe. I was like, okay, anything happens, you know, my family's there. You know, you never know, man. You hear some crazy stories on the internet, plus Netflix has crazy documentaries that you get scared of things. So I remember in our first Zoom call, I'm like, okay, Julian, I got to ask you something. You're not going to kill me, right? Julian was like, no, of course not. Glad we got that out of the way. So I would tell my family, like, of course he's not going to kill me.
He told me so.
Yeah. And then we ended up having my cousin come with us on the trip as like our camera guy because my family was like, you know what? If anything happens, he's going to protect you. And I think we ended up taking care of him because he was like, what do you mean you don't know where you're going to sleep? Because honestly, I'm very like trustworthy. I'm like, whatever, you know, I never really asked that many questions, you know, like where we were going to sleep or anything. So we were packing up to go on the next day. And my cousin's like, all right, so where are we staying? And I'm like, I don't know where we're going to be staying. Let me ask Julian.
Well, even while we were doing it, I didn't have addresses because I was trusting Valley. Valley was like, I'll take care of the hotels. Don't worry. Like I got this whole thing figured out. I was like, okay, sure.
We kind of went in blindsight.
But you know what? Like, okay, so what were the biggest mishaps on that trip? You got food poisoning. That sucked a little bit.
You almost passed out. He got
Heat stroke.
Heat stroke.
Oh, heat stroke. I was going to say altitude.
Food poisoning.
Yeah. Food poisoning. Did we crash?
We crashed. Okay. You were sleeping? And yeah, even my cousin that was there was sleeping too. So I was the only one awake. And I was just chilling there. And I swear the driver that was with us crashed into this huge rock on the side and hits like a full thump. Everybody wakes up. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, who else just saw that?
And like, and like for visual context, like this is in Cusco where they have these like really narrow roads around mountains. And I think a rock had like fallen on the road. And he just... Yeah, that guy was like half asleep.
He was
smashed right in that rock.
Smashed into the rock and then says, I didn't smash into anything. No, I didn't. We get out of the car. It's kind of like squished and it was fucked up. And we're like, boy, you crashed into something.
Yeah, you fucked up.
You fucked up. But what
is
else?
Is that the only place you guys have traveled like extensively together at this point? Like, are you guys still early on this journey together in this capacity?
Oh, well, I guess that we'll get to the next part. So, okay, we do this whole crazy Peru thing, and then by the end, I'm like, yo, like, this is not, like, going to be the last video we do.
Because we realized we worked super well together. Like, it's one thing when you're doing things by yourself, but then when you join forces with other people, it takes it to another level that you didn't even know you could do. And if you think you could do it, it saves you those 10 years of experience to get to that level. And we were on a plane right on our way back from Iquitos back to my to Lima, and Julian sort of like pitched the idea to start a company together. He's like, you know what, we've been rejected by so many companies to do this doc. I'm tired of people not wanting to do the next great thing. We have huge ideas. Nobody wants to fund them. Nobody wants to take the risk.
Yeah, it's super. And like, this is like the key point is like all the stuff that I do, like the number one thing, and they don't tell me the sponsors why they don't want to do it, but it's queer. It's like, it's just risky, right? Like I don't want to chirp podcasts or books or events, but these things are like, we understand we can track the ROI on this stuff pretty easily. Right. When you make a documentary or you make a kooky short that's like based off a meme or you do a talk show, you can't predict what the numbers are going to be on these things. Yeah. And like, you know, to create like the apparatus to build these things too, it's thousands of dollars of editors that makes these things cost way more. And what company in the most volatile space where you have no idea what your cash flow is going to be like month to month when you're selling Bitcoin wants to take a risk on these things? And I just said, well, you know, I've been able to figure it out. You know, I have to sell Bitcoin to do it, but it's been going okay. But every single time I put out a documentary, like the comments I get are like, wow, this was so much better than like the last, you know, 30 things I read or saw about Bitcoin. Like I felt like I actually went somewhere on a journey, or like this was a really crazy perspective, or I just didn't know, you know, like that this was going to be about this. And this is what I'm going to share with my friends and family. This is like unique and interesting, and I don't want to talk up my stuff, but like there's other people in this space who do these types of videos and they get the same comments. Max DeMarco, Joe Nakamoto. We just did like a collaboration with all those guys. We got 15 Bitcoiners to each tell a year of Bitcoin history. Never been done before. And so people are seeing this stuff and it's unique. And it's unique to the Bitcoin space, but it's not really unique to filmmaking in general. It's just that, you know, the class of Bitcoiners just hasn't experimented with all the different formats out there yet. And that's sort of like, that's why I wanted to do this, because Isabella got that idea right away. Our other partner, Adam, who was in town, couldn't be here for this interview, gets that. Like, he's a huge YouTube guy and watches all these different personalities. And the only reason that these people grew their followings and grew their influence is because they thought outside the box and they did some really different stuff. And the Bitcoin space needs that, not only for Bitcoiners to have better stuff to watch, but to get other people to become Bitcoiners. We have the coolest culture. If you've ever been to like a conference, I mean, you know what like the after parties are like and the conversations on the conference hall floors. Like all of us have such interesting stories, such interesting perspectives. And that's the goal, is like, we're going to show all this stuff and we're going to tell these stories and it's going to be a riot.
Well, yeah. There's 8 billion people out there.
Yeah.
They all learn differently. Mm-hmm. There's space for everyone. You know, sometimes people get scared you know, to do a podcast or to think outside the box, they're like, oh, who's going to watch it? There's 8 billion people out there. They all consume different types of content in different ways. Not everybody is going to read you know, 20 Bitcoin books. Somebody might listen to them through audiobooks, or other people just want to watch, you know, a short summary in YouTube about it. So it's just like trying to push the limits in a way that they haven't been explored yet in the industry. And that's what he was like, why don't we just do our own thing? You know, mm-hmm. like we have the ability, like the capacity to do it. And why not? And I was like, you know what? Let's do it.
Yeah. And like yeah. worst case scenario, like we it go fails back, yeah. and we have this catalog of like awesome videos that if Bitcoin ever becomes like, you know, hyper Bitcoinized, we can say, hey, we went to Peru, we went to Guatemala, we did all these things before it was popular. And that was pretty dope.
Yeah, you're taking a chance and you're going to have a story to tell. And it's yeah. it's interesting. I mean, the way you just framed it is really good. So I just a few days ago had an interview. I recorded an interview with Sanjna Mehta, who's a co-founder at Wiser. So they've got the gamified app for learning Bitcoin. And she was talking about, you know, their goal is to onboard 1 billion users to Bitcoin. And there are so many people who aren't going to read the Bitcoin standard, or they're going to get 10 pages in, unfortunately. But, you know, it's just not the way that they're going to digest this information. So they've chosen to gamify it. I think you guys, I don't know how old you all are, but like you're connecting with a generation of people that are constantly looking down at a phone, scrolling through videos and seeing this stuff. And I think it just resonates. It's very effective, especially the short form stuff that I think at least catches their attention. But then once you get that traction and then you launch something long form, like a documentary, you've already got this audience of people who have found you to be engaging and this topic to be interesting, which actually sort of leads me to my next question. So I completely envy your charisma, both of you. Like you guys both have like a way of like captivating the attention of people you're talking to. I'm just an old fart with three kids and, you know, like a very laid back personality. What is it in your background? So it sounds like Isabella, you have a journalism background. It sounds like Julian, I'd love to hear about your background and how you put yourself in front of a camera, get on screen, even like this, just talking. I mean, the energy level is just, it's admirable for someone like me, who's waking up in the middle of the night for, you know, to take care of kids. So what's your background and how do you do it?
8 hours of sleep. No, I'm kidding.
I was a high school drama kid. I loved doing that for a while. Okay, so rewind the clocks. My trajectory in life was always going to be something creative. I've been making like little animations since I was a kid. I really wanted to get into making video games when I was young. And the first paycheck I ever got was, do you remember Newgrounds.com? You ever played Flash games?
I didn't play it. I kind of remember that though. I never played it.
Yeah. So I'm aging myself out here. I'm not that much older. You never played Flash games?
No. What the heck is Flash games?
So like you had a computer lab at school, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you know, at lunchtime, if you're bored, like, you know, they don't have a bunch of games on them, but you had a web browser, right? So on the web browser, you can go to, there's addictinggames.com.
Yes.
Okay. You remember that stuff?
Miniclip.
Yeah. Miniclip.
Oh my
okay.
gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember
those. I didn't know that was called Flash Games.
Yeah. Well, okay. So it ran on something called Adobe Flash. It was like a plugin in your web browser.
Yeah. Okay.
Here's your keyboard and all that. And I was like, I was blown away because it was like, it was, first of all, you could watch some really raunchy animations from this stuff, but that was like that Bitcoin energy back then. It was open source, make whatever you want.
It was open, what?
Yeah, open source, action script, make video games, make animations. And so I loved that. And so I made my own versions of like Mario games, right? Like press up to jump and step on the mushroom Goombas. And I made my own characters. And basically, I thought, okay, now I'm going to make like a real game. What if I made like an hour long Flash game with like a whole story? And I spent like grade 7 to 9 building this thing out, and I sold it to Newgrounds.com. And at the time I sold it for like $1,000, which blew my mind, 2 years of work. And that has always been kind of like, and the bad thing that came out of that, but the good thing was that I put the game out there. Newgrounds has this rating system. People leave reviews. I got shit on. The graphics suck. The gameplay is so clunky.
But you got paid.
I got paid, but like, people are like crapping on me, and like, so, you know, it's the internet. Like, people say like you're a nimwit. Like, you should go
nimwit. What's a nimwit?
You should dig a hole and bury yourself. And like, people are brutal on the internet.
I hadn't noticed,
especially because it's like
because you created a game.
Yeah, like, you're anonymous and you're wasting their time. I guess I don't know. Anyways, great lesson in being able to take feedback. But what came out of that was this like fiery passion of mine to like take on these larger than life projects, like making a whole game for 2 years. In my high school senior year, I made a feature film. It was like a zombie feature film with all my drama friends, hour and 40 minutes. We screened it at like the local cinema. And then I graduated high school and I went to film school. And the idea was that, okay, I'm going to do all my creative stuff and I'll go to Hollywood and I'll become a big shot director. Little did I know that you don't really get into Hollywood by being talented. You get into Hollywood by knowing people. And I've never been like a networker. I've never been a salesy type of person. And the way that you work your way up is you got to volunteer on sets. You've done this before, grab the coffees for like 2-3 years. And then work as like an assistant. And they say, hey, if you're lucky, by the time you're 30, maybe someone will give you a chance to work on something significant. And I was like, fuck that. And, basically said, well, what else do people do to grow? And the other pathway is like, well, you just figure out a way to make films and then eventually people pick you up. So my route was, okay, well, I'm going to get into then doing commercials because basically it's all merit-based. If you're good at editing commercials, you get hired. And so I did a lot of ads. I worked for this great company, Red Ripley, for a couple of years, learning how to edit, you know, corporate videos, commercial spots, long-form stuff. Had my editing chops, just like learned so much more through that job in 6 months than 4 years of film school. And then it was around that time that I found Bitcoin and Ethereum and all that stuff. That changed my life because my net worth increased and then I was able to just say, hey, I'll just do my own business. And then right around 2019, I'm going through like my entire origin story here. The initial question was, what is my background in like presenting?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. What okay. got you to here and why are you so good at it? I guess is kind of where, what
okay.
I'm
well,
about.
Okay. Well, the film stuff explains it a little bit. Yeah, I got my chops editing and filming and I did a bit of acting in school. So I still am a lot more like, I like being behind the camera on a lot of things and producing things for other people. But, you know, I do have fun being sarcastic on camera and cheeky.
But you wanted to be an actor.
Yeah, yeah, I did at one point.
He's good at both. You're good at being on camera because the thing you have, you're good at telling jokes too.
All the actors are going to be replaced by AI. So I'm glad I didn't go down that route. I think the creative editing types and the visionaries, like, it's going to take a while for AI to like start doing Spielberg stuff, right? But
bro, come on. Did you not see the new AI trailer for the James Bond movie?
Christian Bale's going to feel like such a chump. Because they're going to be able to do like the AI skinniness. Like they did for Captain America, they got pretty good. But like this whole idea, like I'm going to gain 50 pounds, lose 50 pounds. Like it's silly. It's dumb. It's bad for your body. Hollywood's not going to force people to do that. It's going to be like CGI AI stuff.
That in the future. Sucks.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Slowly turning into Wall-E.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all going to be fat in the chairs.
Yeah.
And AI is going to make us skinny.
Yeah, we're going to have like these like beautiful Tinder photos. And then,
that'd
like,
be so funny.
Meet in person in the chairs. So I got my chops through work, through practicing on these massive projects, through getting grilled. My favorite people are the people who really, really criticize and tear apart my work because I hate them at first. But then I realized, oh my God, there's very few people in the world who can rip apart what you do and you emerge out a stronger person because of it. So I do appreciate people who are very critical. And I think that's why I've gotten to where I've gotten. I used to hate criticism and the people in film school, they don't like it. You know, you're trying to pat everyone on the back and not offend people and tell them their film is shit. But I never fit in with that culture. I really liked being grilled by people and made better. Like there's a difference between being an asshole and being constructive, but I think that's why the stuff is good. I think that's why I've been able to improve my own camera presence as I watch those old videos back. And I have friends who are brutally honest if I'm being cringy or not. And then, you know, when Isabella makes stuff, like I'm grilling her all the time on her accent and her enunciation, like very particular things. But you learn over time.
Yeah, that's how you improve.
You learn over time. You have these mentors who just grill you, and then you are able to pass on that knowledge over time.
So, I feel like we're in a society where people cannot critique others anymore, and people get so offended. But the thing is, no one's learned, no one's born knowing. Mm-hmm. So if people don't give you feedback, they don't critique you, and they're like, oh, this is great. How are you supposed to grow from that?
Yeah, no, artists are soft. And I think that's why like Bitcoin and art is like a match made in heaven, because Bitcoiners are brutally honest. Like I've seen Bitcoiners and we're all on the same mission, but like, you know, we get these like Sailor and Odell and this and that, like even though we all want Bitcoin to be perfect, you know, the ideological rifts are intense. The criticism and like you've seen the Twitter threads where people are debating, mm-hmm. it's intense. There's hard feelings sometimes, and other times people are able to walk away from things. But Bitcoiners don't let each other get away with slack and pats on the back, right? Like there's no complacency allowed. It's about what you built, not what you talk yourself up to be. And for me as an artist, I really love that because it allows me to actually improve what I'm doing and challenge myself versus just have people. And like, I love the compliments and I love everyone who's like so nice to us and, you know, really loves our work. But like the people I spend my time around are the people who are like, yeah, your last video was okay. You know, you could have done this better. And it's like, ugh. But you realize like it's very meaningful to you when you get those types of comments.
So. Yeah. Well, no, I think you each bring something different to the table the way I mean, you both have, I think, an energy that's very engaging. I think Isabella, I think your accent is endearing. And I think I think the sarcasm and like the Julian, like some of just the, I don't know how to describe it, but like a lot of the shorts are, they just like, they pull you in really quickly. And I think that's part of the reason why you've had the success you've had in terms of engagement is just, it's like digestible, you know, but it's also, it keeps it interesting. Let's talk about, two videos that you, each of you has done, that I watched recently. And Julian, I think the first one you mentioned, I think it was TikTok took it down in like 48 seconds or something like that. Could you explain what that video was, why you think that happened, which I think will probably be apparent to most people, but then also to the degree to which you experience or have to think about circumventing censorship in the work that you're doing? Do you remember what it was?
That's like, yeah. It was the climate truths one. Mm-hmm. First of all, I learned that if you tell the internet that you just got censored on like another platform, people are like, whoa, I got to watch this video now. So
yeah,
not that good what marketing. Happened wasn't true, but yeah. Like that's a really good way to get engagement. Just be like, yo, I got banned on this. I got banned on that. I got banned on TikTok for that video immediately. Why? Because as soon as you upload a video to TikTok, it creates a transcription of it into their servers. And the first thing I'm talking about is how climate change is a bigger money laundering scheme than the military industrial complex. So you can look at all the keywords in that video, China CO2 emissions greater than the US, climate change, money laundering. Like it was immediate, and the tag was misinformation. Mm-hmm. Right. And I've had a couple, and they don't tell you like specifically what is misinformation, mm-hmm. but you kind of know. Right. Yeah. And I try in those shorts, it's hard. Like you can't really read all the headlines I put in the shorts, but it's like, if you pause the video, like there is a receipt somewhere usually when I say something and you know, you can dig around for it. But yeah, I mean like I love these. I came up with that format like a couple months ago. I mean, I didn't come up with it. People have been doing stitches for a while, but I try and get like really intense with it. And then I'm like, anyways, guys, sorry. That was a little bit too much. Like here's a cat video.
Yeah.
And people like that because it's like a juxtaposition of like this raw intensity with, hey, go back to your like scrolling, and it kind of just wakes people up. But like that video to me and like the other ones I've done in that format, it's about like how we are sold packaged lies that are very convincing that you can't question. And there's a lot of great people who speak the truth on the internet, but you have to, I think, you get labeled very quickly on the internet. Like this is a libertarian, you know, crazy head. He's a ANCAP and he's a conservative, or he's like a left wing wokey. And so what I really have fun doing is sort of playing both sides a little bit more where, you know, I don't come off. I feel, you know, maybe now, cause you've seen like a bunch of them, you know, I come off as like a crazy anti-government libertarian. But I think initially when people see me, they don't think, oh, this guy's like some crazy like right winger. Like, I don't feel like I give off that vibe necessarily. Yeah. I don't think Isabella gives off that vibe. But, you know, we have our beliefs about like the state of the world, that there are two genders, that, you know, Epstein didn't kill himself, that climate change is a money laundering scheme for the most part that is taken advantage by rich people to sell products to governments. And you hear these things come out of her mouth, and it's kind of interesting. It's not like we don't look like Alex Jones, right? Or yeah. Russell Brand. We you know, try and connect with people on like a more base level, but you have fun with it, and that's how you open the door to getting people to listen to you that normally wouldn't. So
yeah. Well, it's funny you say about the TikTok ban, because so before we started working together, got shadow banned, but bad. The thing is, I started doing this series about Jeffrey Epstein on TikTok, and they were blowing up. I'm talking about like 4.6 million views. It was a really good series, because the thing was, at the time, I found a Twitter account that was releasing, this is all public information that is all posted online, so anybody can go and look this up. It's not that I was going out of my way, interviewing people, doing my own research, and revealing the truths. This is all in the internet. So this person was releasing the names of the people that went to Epstein's Island that was in the Little Black Book. And I was like, okay, why don't I do a series on TikTok about these people and their connections to Jeffrey Epstein? And I start releasing, I released one and it did really well. So I was like, okay, I'll keep doing it, because people were super intrigued. And my mistake was that I was using my name and my face in this series. And I didn't know how big of an issue this was, because I kept reading in the comments, your account is going to get banned. You have a lot of balls showing your face and talking about this. Be careful. Someone's going to come and you're mysteriously going to die. And I thought, obviously, I'm a girl with like, I don't know, I had like 200K followers in Twitter and TikTok. What are they going to do? No one's going to come get me. I'm talking about these millionaires that are related to Jeffrey Epstein. I do around 10 episodes of it, and the weirdest stuff started happening to me, not only online, but in real life as well. At the time, I used to live by myself in an apartment, and I would get random calls from downstairs telling me like, hey, you have a delivery. Did you do Uber Eats? I'm like, no, please do not send them up. Then I would get random calls. The thing is, it's weird because anyway, my phone number says that I live somewhere else. So I kept getting phone calls from that same area code. And they weren't like people that, you know, know those random salespeople that are trying to sell you something. It would just be just like I would answer the phone and then nothing. I would just sit there thinking, okay, they're going to, you know, pitch me something, try to sell insurance. No, nothing. Just blank silence. And my family started getting really scared because they would call them as well. And when they figured out what I was doing, my mom's like, you need to stop putting these videos out there, because you're putting not only yourself in danger. If you want to kill yourself, go kill yourself. But you're going to affect us, because they're going to know where we live and all this stuff. And at the beginning, I wasn't taking it too seriously. Yeah. And then everything that I read in those comments was starting to get to become true. All of a sudden, my videos would get taken down. And I'd be like, what do you mean? Why is it taken down? I would go into it because I mentioned the Clintons. That's when all the fishy stuff started happening. I mentioned the Clintons and they took down that video. And I was like, what are they taking it out for? Copyright infringement. Like, what is copyrighted? And then all of a sudden, my videos, they weren't getting pushed out. So I would put a video and I would have 10 views. And then I would go to the comments and people are like, why am I not getting your videos anymore? They're not popping up on my feed. I followed just so I could continue seeing this. And all this stuff started happening. Every time I post a video now on TikTok, my video gets takes about 30 minutes to post, because they have to now see it and I guess view it if I'm saying anything that is, you know, too crazy. And well, now I can't even use the platform because it's stupid. All my videos that I post, they don't get any views. And I still have the followers that are on it, but they start dwindling away because I can't post anything. It doesn't get past, it doesn't get shown to them. And it's all because you're talking about something that is public knowledge because it's out there, but they don't want you to know about it.
Yeah. That is wild.
Touch the Clintons, man.
Yeah, no, you got to be careful with that. People disappear. Oh, now we're going to get banned.
I cannot stand up here. Don't get me.
But they try to shut you down. That's the thing. It's so fucked up. Everything is public, but when you start talking about it, they want you to be quiet. And they do. They silence everybody that tries to speak out. So they are raising everybody with fear. So you're too scared to speak up because obviously they're going to kill you. And then if you don't care about your life, they'll go after your family. So it's kind of insane how the whole system works. What mind blows me the most is that all this is public information.
Yeah.
And people do know about it, but there's not, like, we still let them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just like bringing it together, like bringing this information together and packaging it in a concise way that people can absorb quickly. That's the danger. Like, the danger isn't the fact that bad stuff happened. The danger is someone's going to like articulate this in a way that is going to reach millions of people. And I think that's what your content does. I mean, and today it's mostly Bitcoin, but you touch on all of these other topics. So it doesn't shock me that you guys would be amongst the banned or shadow banned on various platforms. There is
the list of the ones that are killed.
Yeah.
It's crazy. They kill people in the most, you know, subtle way possible. Oh, this person was walking, got run over by a car. Yeah. Cardiac arrest at 30 years old.
Oh, yeah. my favorite, and like, you know, maybe these things aren't linked, is like the guy who sues the Federal Reserve for not disclosing how much money they gave to the banks. And he wins. The first person ever sued the Federal Reserve wins, dies of a heart attack 3 months later.
Coincidence?
No one talks about it.
I think not.
Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show. But I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company.
And I think that's the, I think more and more people are sort of broadly aware that this stuff is happening. They realize there's censorship. I don't think they understand what an acute problem it is, because even most people in my circle of people in my life are generally pretty sharp people. I'd say mostly like more right leaning. So like, they're not, you know, like maybe the excited, you know, pro vax kind of, they're not conspiracy theorists generally, but they are open to maybe distrust of the government, right? And they would not, if they heard this conversation, I think they'd be like, yeah, I know it's kind of a problem, but I don't think it's really that big of a deal. I don't think they realize the gravity of the situation in which we find ourselves.
But the thing is, you can't even do anything about it. You know all this information. Now what? You go against them, you die. You don't say anything, you stay alive. So it's kind of like, it makes you realize why people stay quiet. It's because you sort of want to live, you know, mm-hmm. You want to, you know, have kids, and your kids have other kids. But the thing is, when you have this agenda and you know what they're doing and you know it's bad, you can't stop them from doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we all gain up on them. I think that's one thing people don't realize. They're outnumbered. If we there's 8 billion of us out there. If all of us can put our differences aside and just, you know, focus on the common good and try to stop, you know, the top 0.001% that control the whole world. Mm-hmm. Maybe we have a chance. If not, they're going to kill us slowly, you know, with their mosquito, their artificial mosquitoes that they're building out there. Oh, yeah. The vaccines, the food.
Anyway, we can't keep talking about this stuff. He's going to get his podcast.
Yeah, we're going to be banned.
That's so true. Yeah, no. This is going to get censored
on YouTube.
Yep.
But I think, like, there's one person in mind who's in particular close proximity to me who is very smart. And she, but I think what it is, I think the delta for her is like, she wants to feel like there's someone out there kind of taking care of things. Like the government is there for us and they want what's best for us. And it's like, it's a complete lie and there's no evidence that that is true, but your little world is shattered if you begin to ask these questions and go far enough down the rabbit hole. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge for most people.
But you can't blame them.
Yeah.
Because I've had this conversation with my mom, and my mom's mentality now, obviously it's different because she's researched and everything. But before, during the pandemic with vaccines, she was pro vaccines. And I asked her, I was like, why did you make all of us get vaccines? You know, why did you do this? Because my mentality was like, I got vaccinated because everybody that I loved got vaccinated. And I was like, yo, if they're all going to die and I'm going to be the only one standing here, you know, I'm not going to, what am I going to do? You know, what's life if you don't have people you love to share it with?
Mm-hmm.
And I got so mad at her. I was like, why did you make us do it? You know, because, you know, we know that in a family, the mom, the wife is the one that rules everything. She's the one that says what's right and what's wrong. And she goes to me like genuinely hurt and says, what did you expect me to do? Why would I think the government would want to hurt us? I've been raised from such a young age, you know, like, they tell us to vaccinate our kids with chickenpox, with, you know, not scoliosis, like you know, all these vaccines that they make your child get at such a young age. Why would I think anything different of this vaccine?
Mm-hmm.
The government is like the literal embodiment of don't verify trust. Like, don't go out and do the work because you're a conspiracy theorist, a weirdo or whatever. If you actually try and verify data, just trust us.
Yeah.
It's the exact opposite of the Bitcoin ethos.
Yeah.
It does, yeah. But you can't blame them because when you've been raised, even America, we were such a patriarch, like such a driven country, you know, with the founding fathers, people died for the country. That's how much they loved and trusted, you know, America, the people in charge. So if you tell that generation, you know, they are not looking for your best interest in mind, you know, they're like, what do you mean? You know, my grandpa, you know, fought for us. How am I going to question them?
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's a huge, all goes back to them.
It's a huge mental hurdle for a lot of people. And I completely understand. I mean, I've only been in Bitcoin for 2 years. And so, you know, COVID for me was before I kind of went down this rabbit hole. And I still have a profound appreciation for my country, for its origins, the founding documents, the principles upon which the United States was built. But we are so far removed from that in practice as for it to be unrecognizable. And so that's sort of my message to people who, like me, historically and through upbringing, have been very big proponents of, you know, like this national identity. Like I completely can relate to that. I totally get it. We've got a lot of good things to be proud of historically, but that's not the country in which we live anymore. And you just have to, begin to open your eyes and appreciate it and recognize it for what it is. And I think there are so many people who have benefited for so long from things the way they are that they can't see that the foundation is breaking and affecting a new generation of people disproportionately, you know? So there's so many places we could go. Honestly, this conversation is irrelevant because they're just going to take it down as soon as I post it at this point. But no, I want to go back, Isabella, to the video that I watched that you did, I think, fairly recently on Ethereum. So this was a slightly longer form. I think it was 10 or 12 minutes long. So your content ranges in terms of like the topics you address. What about, so I knew a little bit about it. I didn't go very far down the crypto rabbit hole before I found Bitcoin and found my second love besides my wife. What was it that it inspired the video? And I'm curious too, like what sort of research goes into that? Is like, Julian, are you the one doing the production? Like how long does it take to make a 12-minute video that's pretty involved in terms of, you know, the story you're telling?
You know, so it takes an army. No, I'm kidding.
It's teamwork.
It's honestly, I cannot take credit. My face is on it, but it's
Do you have a script? Are you reading off of a script or are you, yeah.
So the thing is, you know how we were talking in the beginning, how me and Julian started working together and these are one of the videos that we wanted to do, you know, push the boundaries, videos that big companies are not willing to talk about because they don't want to lose sponsors. Mm-hmm. It's more like an unfiltered, topic because we're going to be talking about a lot of things that people probably don't want to hear about. Mm-hmm. There are probably going to be episodes that are going to get banned, but you'll probably have to see them on Noster. But the idea behind this is one person can't create this huge, you know, big thing. And right, the first video we had, so it took us three people. You know, we have our writer, Angelo, who's a genius. Actually, he's kind of, his story is even crazier than both of us. He dropped out of school at the age of 12.
Wow.
That's like some savage, you know, Bitcoiner move because he ended up like stumbling upon Bitcoin. And
when he was like 14 or 15 and it became his life.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. He's written books and everything.
Yeah.
So, he was the editor, producer, director, and he flew to Isla Mujeres to where I am and helped me build the set. So if you see the set, it gives you pirate vibes. That was more of the idea, what we wanted to do, you know, create something different. It's not that, it's sort of like a crazy person, you know, that comes from this pirate ship and is giving you.
Yeah, all kind of yeah.
And to produce that video, it took us sort of like months, I would say a month worth of prep.
I think like the initial idea though is that like I found Bitcoin in 2013 to buy vegetables online. And then I didn't talk about it for 3 years. I didn't care. I was like, this is my vegetable buying tool. And then I got my veggies and I stopped caring. And then 2016, I get back into it, but I didn't get back into Bitcoin immediately. I got into Ethereum because I was sold the unit bias thing. Wow, Bitcoin's like $500. This Ethereum thing's only like $3, $4. Let's get some of this. Also, this seems cool. It has contracts in it, all this fun stuff. So within 3 days of me buying Ethereum, the DAO fork happens where essentially Ethereum loses all credibility of it being decentralized. Not that it kind of should have deserved it in the first place, but this whole idea of like, oh, this hacker made off with like a bunch of the ether supply because of some random community project. Let's like invalidate his coins. It's kind of too early. Like, you know, he took too many ether. So let's invalidate his coins. Well, if he had a smaller amount, would they have done it? If he had a bigger amount, would it have been less controversial? Anyways, they create a fork of Ethereum where the hacker's coins that he got, and I would say, I don't know, is hacking illegal? You're taking a contract that someone made and exploiting a very visible problem in it, and you're taking the funds. Now, there's white hat hackers, there's black hat hackers. The white hats give it back. The black hats run away with it. It's their bounty. But this is how protocols get stronger. And so what does the Ethereum Foundation do? Well, they say, screw this guy. We're going to just invalidate his funds and we're going to just pretend it never happened. And then, in 2 years, we're going to actually get rid of mining entirely. And so like I was still into Ethereum even after that fork, but something felt a little bit wrong to me. I'm like, and that's why I wasn't as convicted into crypto as, or Bitcoin or whatever, in the beginning as much as I probably could have been, because it was like, okay, this is decentralized, but these like corporations can come and just like undo it. And I really had to learn about Bitcoin and how that wasn't possible in Bitcoin. And I lived through like the blockchain wars and the Bitcoin Cash fork. And it was really hard. Like, people make it sound so easy. Like, oh, if you bought Bitcoin in 2011 and just held, you know, you'd be like X, you know, millionaire or billionaire now. But like, there are so many moments along the way up until about 2020, I would say, where it was like, yeah, this thing could fail overnight. People don't remember that in 2017, the Bitcoin Cash hard fork was about 10% away at one point from flipping Bitcoin. It was 10% away, right? And we all pretend that like, oh, Bitcoin Cash was a scam from the beginning. It's like, yeah, really? The market was telling you like within like minutes and a god candle that Bitcoin Cash would have been dominant. And again, it's one of these things where like, you know, there's the blocks and there's the block organization that tells you what the dominant chain is, but the price is a huge factor in this as well. And you think if the price of Bitcoin Cash held days at a higher rate than Bitcoin, that we would be here talking to today? I don't think so.
Yeah.
It would be Bitcoin Cash's world right now and not Bitcoin's. And so when we talk about how, you know, these things are like immutable, it's like, no, they're still based on human error and human consensus. And as we understand the asset, we get better and we ossify and we kind of, you know, define our own destinies with these things. But getting back to Ethereum, no one told the story of the DAO hack. I literally couldn't find like a good video on it if you tried. And no one's told the story of the pre-sale. And like everyone in the Bitcoin space kind of has like a vague understanding of it. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't seen anyone explain it, you know, well enough. And I thought, well, what if we like frame it? And we talked to Angela about this. What if we frame it as if Vitalik was Satoshi? Because if that was the fact, and the reason that we all think Bitcoin is amazing is because Satoshi gifted it to the community. He pulled himself out of it. Bitcoin would not exist today if Satoshi was still active and, you know, shit posting on bitcointalk.org. He left early on to give it to the community. But Vitalik stuck around and Vitalik had this pre-sale and Vitalik did all this. And this is why Ethereum will never be global money. And yeah.
No hate to Vitalik.
You know, I would say, look, here's the question at that video is like, is Vitalik or Ethereum a net positive for the world?
Well, it even goes, even we say in the video, there's a portion where it's like, is Ethereum confused? Because Vitalik even released not too long ago an article saying, make Ethereum cypherpunk again. Mm-hmm. So it shows you that even the founder that of the whole project is confused to what it turned out to be. Mm-hmm. So obviously everyone's entitled to do whatever they want. People have probably made people have made millions of Ethereum, you know, and there's no hate to it, but people have to call things how they are. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter if they're right or wrong. It's just, this is what happened. And what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
I was reading some of the comments and people get so offended. And it's like, bro, chill. All the receipts are there. This is not coming made up from my head. It's what happened. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. You know, you could either choose to ignore it, which is what people have been doing, or accept it and move on and be like, yeah, this happened. And I still, I don't know, bought Ethereum.
Yeah.
So what? There's nothing wrong with that. People get so offended. It's like, it is what it is, man.
Yeah.
Just call the shots how it is.
I think the important thing is just that it's framed as it is, right? I think that's maybe my like, go do what you want. I mean, people waste their time on a lot of things that I don't personally find valuable. But to call for a flippening or to compare conflate Bitcoin and Ethereum or any other token out there, it's just like, what is it that you think you're accomplishing? Cause I'm pretty clear on what my mission with Bitcoin is. Right. And if you think it's global sound money, and you're also partnering with what the World Economic Forum in certain capacities, and this is how it originated and it was, you know, effectively, the pre-mine alone is a non-starter for me. I think that's maybe my biggest problem. Yeah. So I guess my question then, because we've talked about a few different sorts of topics you cover, what could you like, how would you distill and summarize the mission of and by the way, is Gitbased, is that like the brand that you guys sort of
get
think?
Based, okay. Baby.
Okay. How do you define the mission of Gitbased?
I'm going to let you take this one.
This one, I feel like the mission of Get Based is exposing the truth and without a filter. You know, calling things how it is, not from an opinion based, because we all have opinions, but if we don't have facts to back them up, mm-hmm. you know, and we Get Based is a production company where we obviously want to make people based, you know,
right.
be awake from what's happening, wake up from, you know, the simulator. And my show called Wrong Think. I don't know if you guys have read 1984, but that's where it comes from. I mm-hmm. read that book when I was in high school, and I cannot stop talking about it because everything in that book is coming true.
Mm-hmm.
And its message, it's so genuine. And the craziest part of the whole book, 1984, was that George Orwell actually wrote the book in 1948. So he was projecting in the future of what he thought was going to happen, how things were happening. And we sort of want to wake people up, and not only with Wrong Thing, but also with Future Proof and the docs and the shorts. We have different types of content because we understand that there's different people out there, and they consume videos differently. You know, someone might not like my style of video, and that's okay. So you have Future Proof, or you have the shorts, or you have the docs. It doesn't matter. What we just want to do is put the truth out there from what we've seen and what we've experienced, because not everybody is going to take time out of their day to fly to Peru, to fly to Costa Rica, to see what's going on, to go to El Salvador, see how the Bitcoin circular economy is working out. And we kind of do that without having them to leave the comfort of their own home. Because let's be real, most people work a 9-to-5. And we kind of want to expose the system in a way and how they've made us become so dependent on them. I can go on, because all I'm thinking is they make us get these 9-to-5 jobs, make our kids go to school, you know, as a daycare, because we're not really learning much in the school systems. And then we get these 9-to-5s. We can't quit because our family depends on that income that we've been slowly, you know, kind of like tied to do. And it's just a vicious cycle out there.
The travel is a really big component for me, and it's like the impetus of why I really want to do this, because like one of my favorite YouTube channels is this one called Yes Theory. I don't know if you know them, but it's like, it's three dudes, and they started this company out of a one bedroom apartment. And the idea was to push themselves outside their comfort zone, because that is the only way you end up really learning things in life, is to really get uncomfortable and expose yourself to either the truths or the crazy realities of how other people live or how other situations are. And I just hadn't seen that done in Bitcoin, which is really weird, because Bitcoin is all about being uncomfortable, right? You're storing your money in a magical internet currency that is only secured by the 12 words that you manage to figure out how to not lose. Like, it's such an uncomfortable process. I mean, even to this day, like, you still get sweaty palms when you send like 5 figures of Bitcoin to like random addresses. Yeah, it's super uncomfortable. And it's never like, maybe they'll figure out a way for me to send like $6,000 over the internet without my palms sweating. But I think it's still going to happen a couple of years from now. And the thing that surprised me was that like the media didn't reflect that. It's a lot of people who are comfortable, and they're so into the Bitcoin world that it's almost like if you don't get it, you can't be a part of it. And the alternative to that is it's all these mainstream media journalists who are going to all these different places and saying, oh, look at El Salvador's failed Bitcoin experiment, or, you know, Elizabeth Warren's right, it's all about money laundering. And there's just no in between where you get that like global perspective, that kind of fun perspective, but, you know, you're also moved out of your seat a little bit. And that's like the main impetus for me, is we have our shows that we're going to, you know, do regularly, but, you know, hopefully those are kind of the anchors that allow us to do these really more experimental documentaries and kind of wild trips. And like, that's going to be the legacy of what we're doing, is really like getting us out of our comfort zone and bringing people along with us on these journeys and doing the collaborations. So,
and it's funny that you mention the, you know, the mainstream media. I used to work for media. I've been in like the media industry for a while. And what people don't realize is how censored they are. They're people that are running this and that choose what's published out there. Mm-hmm. You know, they choose what famous people they're going to talk about, what story. If the executive producer doesn't like it or doesn't believe in it, boom, that story's out. Mm. And a cool thing about Get Based is it's not what we like. It's what the people need to hear. And that's one of our, I feel like our miss, like our big goal is to, you know, talk about the truth, whether we approve of it or not, you know, even if you have, like you said, you were into Ethereum. We exposed Ethereum. It doesn't matter if you still own it or you don't own it, whatever it is.
The second video I ever made on my channel was, this is what Ethereum is, Ethereum Explained. And I unlisted the video, not because I wanted to censor that video, but because I want to clean up the channel. But like you can, I mean, if you've been watching my stuff for a while, you can see the journey. I used to be a shitcoiner, and I'm not afraid of that. I'm not going to hide it. I made videos for ICOs. I made the promo videos for ICOs. I took ICO coins as payment. I had to unlearn all that stuff, and it was a process, right? Yeah. And that's not the only thing that we have to unlearn in life. You know, it's not just, you know, don't buy shitcoins. It's like, don't trust everything from the government. Don't trust things on the labels of the packages of things that you buy. And, you know, do enough of that stuff and you get based.
But let's not go too far. During the pandemic in 2020, all over the news, they were saying, you cannot travel, you cannot travel, traveling bans. I literally left the country the peak pandemic during March. And I remember having a full-on conversation with the people in immigration. I was like, oh my goodness, if I leave the country, am I not going to come back again? And the girl looked at me and was like, girl, we can't ban borders. You can obviously come and leave as you please. The media is just portraying this stupid narrative, and that's where it all starts.
Yeah.
So people need to realize that all these companies, Fox, CNN, CNBC, or whatever they're called, they're one, they're ancient, and two, they're run by people in power. So whether you want it, or to see it or not, those stories that you see on it, they're all pre-approved by people that don't have the best interest for you.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. So if your mission, if you accomplish your mission and if Bitcoin goes where we think it's going to go, right, however you define hyper-Bitcoinization, what do you think is the most fundamental change, or maybe a couple of fundamental changes that we see in the world?
I do, honestly, if I'm being honest, I don't think we are going to live to see hyper-Bitcoinization. Mm-hmm. Seeing how the world
How are you defining hyper-Bitcoinization then? Because I imagine you still think over the next 10 or 20 years.
We have different answers on this.
Yeah, well, the thing is, so I honestly, if we, I have a, how do I say this? If the Bitcoiners now don't spend time to teach other people and try to educate them in the way that they can, it's going to take longer. You know, there's like the saying that goes, if you tell yourself you're going to clean your room in a month, it's going to take you a month to clean your room. But if you tell yourself you're going to clean your room in 3 hours, it's going to take you 3 hours to clean the room. And I obviously I do know like the Bitcoin protocol has to evolve and get better. But one of the big things that I've noticed is people are working on the protocol, but they're forgetting the people, you know? Yeah, if we get the protocol to work, then we also need to build on a system to educate the people that are out there that are going to use the system. And many Bitcoiners, I've realized, that are woke and everything, they're like, oh, you got to read all these 20 books and we got to be real. Nobody's going to go read those 20 books. Mm-hmm. The real people and the people that need Bitcoin the most, they don't have time for that. They're going to use Bitcoin as peer-to-peer. And obviously, like, I love the core of Bitcoin, that it's freedom, you know, bringing money, you know, giving you the, you know, the keys to your coin. You're going to be the one that's in charge of your own money. These people don't care about that. Mm-hmm. And by, I mean, these people is the people that are, you know, living in the outskirts of Peru on an island in Mexico that have that are not banked, that don't have bank accounts, don't even know what a bank is. Their nearest bank is 2 hours away. Those people, first, they don't even care if the government is fucking them over because they've been fucked over so many times that that doesn't even cross their mind. They just want to be able to exchange their money. So it goes back to the white paper and Satoshi's original vision, making Bitcoin a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. And I think being in America and realizing, oh, we got to create Bitcoin as a store of value first, and all these steps that you got to follow, is there's people that don't really care. They don't care about savings. They'll never probably save. They just want to, you know, get rid of the middleman, or heck, they've never even had the middleman. So I think in order to see hyper-Bitcoinization, we need to also teach the people how to do it. And I know there's, you know, I don't know if you guys have heard of Mi Primer Bitcoin. They are insane. They're out there doing the work in El Salvador, you know, teaching people how to run their own node, teaching them about the basics, the fundamentals, about, you know, freedom. Heck, they're even teaching them why the dollar became to be, you know, the actual global money. You know, everybody talks in the US dollar, but nobody knows why. So it's, I do think to see that, we're going to need to see more people going out there and teaching other people about this.
Yeah. So, Julian, what about you? How do you think the world changes or is shaped by this?
My view is that I think in order to figure out what the benchmark is for hyper-Bitcoinization, we have to figure out what hyper-fiatization was. And I think we all agree that hyper-fiatization was when the U.S. officially abandoned the gold standard and said, yeah, we're not backing nothing here, right? That is when we can kind of collectively agree that was like the birth of fiat in our modern world. And I think essentially what has to happen for hyper-Bitcoinization is that either the U.S. gives it a stamp of approval and it backs its own currency with it, or... And this is the one that I think that happens first, is Bitcoin's market cap passes gold. I think the day that that happens, not everyone's going to have Bitcoin in their wallet, but that to me is not what hyper-Bitcoinization is about. Hyper-Bitcoinization is about a paradigm shift that ripples across like 5-10,000 years of humanity happening. No asset, no bearer instrument has usurped the market cap of gold, I believe, ever. Could be wrong. Maybe there was more oil than gold, but we don't know really. Like, we have a rough understanding of how much gold there is. When we have a clear understanding that the value of all the Bitcoin in the world is more than all of the circulating supply of gold, I think that's the moment that people say, okay, this is, I mean, right now you and I think it's unstoppable, right? But the governments are still trying to stop it. But there will be a point, and I think when it passes gold, the governments will say, yeah, it is unstoppable. Like, we can't do anything about it. And what is that? Like, I think the Bitcoin price has to hit, you know, $400,000 or $500,000.
Yeah, five or six maybe. But yeah, yeah.
That doesn't seem that far away, honestly. Like, yeah. You know, NVIDIA 10x in a year. But it started off at like a much smaller starting point. We have to accrue another $12 trillion of value into the asset. And then we have to make sure that gold also doesn't really move, because gold will also keep getting valuable if they both have a similar thesis. But that's my thesis for hyper-Bitcoinization. Mm-hmm. When that happens, all of humanity's like collective productivity will probably very rapidly shift towards Bitcoin development. Like, we're having problems with Lightning and Liquid and all that stuff. Yeah, that's because like, what, a handful, maybe there's like, you know, 4,000 serious developers in the world right now working on like a layer two, like technology stack from a protocol level.
Yeah.
Lucky if there's 4,000 devs. How many people are working on like AI and cloud and all that stuff? We're talking about hundreds of thousands, millions of people. So we think, oh, you know, like Bitcoin's not ready yet. Yeah, it's because we don't have like the collective power of humanity trying to make this thing happen, right? But as soon as you start becoming, you know, too big to ignore, the acceleration towards all of these solutions happening happens at a rapid pace. I really believe it's not an engineering problem that we don't have a functional, like, you know, a universal layer two. It's a manpower thing. We simply don't have enough minds in rooms together to figure out, you know, how to create this protocol, to do layer two Bitcoin effectively. But it's like, it's going to happen, and it's going to come out of nowhere. because of the price driving the action is what I think. The Lightning Network was invented out of necessity back in like 2015, 2016 for that exact reason, right? It was like, shit, fees are getting expensive. I can't use it to buy coffee on chain anymore. Also, 10 minutes sucks. And, you know, Blockstream and a couple of the other developers were like, yeah, let's do this. And they made it work, right? The price of Bitcoin goes high enough, and then everybody from Google to Amazon to Apple to Microsoft is going to come together and figure out, you know, a perfect protocol for moving Bitcoin anywhere, you know, beyond on-chain.
Yeah.
You make it sound so easy, but I think like the government's going to fight like hell.
Oh, they're going to fight like hell.
Keep that from happening.
They're going to fight like hell, but at the same time, you're going to have governments that are aligned with our cause as well. Freedom-loving governments, you know, well, we can agree or disagree. Like El Salvador, like a lot of these other nations that want to see this thing succeed out of their own personal greed, right? Like, if I own a huge treasury of Bitcoin, I want to have my people have it as legal tender. I'm going to make sure that there's a layer two. I'm going to put money towards making sure there's a layer two. You know, if I don't have enough Bitcoin developers in my country and I want to reap the rewards of whatever they design, whatever wallet they design, like I'm going to create the incentives for that to happen as well. So you're going to have retaliatory governments like the US, but you're also going to have ones that really want to see it succeed as well.
Yeah. But the ones that are going to keep it from succeeding are the biggest governments that are ruling the world.
Yeah, but no one can keep it from succeeding, though, is what I think.
Yes, but I think it's going to be a slow, gradual. Yeah.
I think that Corey Clipston of Swan has sort of an interesting thesis on this, and that's we need to reach this, what he calls the intransigent minority. So it's a large enough minority of people who are pro-Bitcoin that you, if you stand against it as an authority or a political figure, it's to your own detriment. Like right now, Elizabeth Warren can get away with hating on Bitcoin because there aren't enough constituents that she serves, to the extent you want to call anything she does service. There aren't enough of those people who care about Bitcoin to give her the boot, right? But once we reach that, it's just going to be par for the course, I think, that candidates are pro Bitcoin. And so I think the question is how quickly we get there. One thing that I think is important is hitting six figures. I think a whole new wave of people revisit the concept of Bitcoin when we hit $100,000 a coin, because it's just like a psychological thing. And then I think another bigger wave revisits at 250 or 500 or whatever it is. And hopefully, to your point, Julian, that as we creep up on gold, we also are bringing this wave of adoption that there are enough of those people who reach that intransigent minority of people to be a powerful voting block. And I guess we're, you know, it's just a matter of time and waiting to see. We'll see how quickly that happens. And his point is we either get enough people on board that it's politically impossible to try shutting Bitcoin down, or we have a war that could extend for decades. And so I think how that thesis plays out determines which of you is more directionally correct on how this is all gonna work. But I suppose
I see the war happening.
Yeah. And it sounds like, Julian, you think we're unstoppable enough in the short term that there are going to be opponents. Absolutely. I think we would all agree on that, but it's not going to be a total bloodbath in terms of achieving, you know, like this 500, 600K that we need to reach to surpass gold, say that's the number. You think that's going to happen in the shorter term, four, eight, 10 years?
I don't think it's going to happen like tomorrow. I don't think we're going to hit 500, 600K.
Next decade, though?
Might be slower than we think. I think Bitcoiners are in for a rude awakening with the whole like 50%, you know, compound annual growth rate. That's going to be wrecked, I think, in the next like 10 years. My take is that I think the real fight will be after. I think, honestly, in the longer term scope of things, we're going to sleepwalk to passing gold. I don't think, because we're going to creep up. Oh, suddenly we're half of gold's market cap. Oh, suddenly it's like 3/4. And then maybe one day we wake up to like a God candle and, oh, we're bigger than gold now. And then, because governments are slow, they're very reactive. And you're seeing some stuff now and you can say, oh, Wasabi or Samurai and all that.
Wasabi?
Wasabi's next, man. Samurai and all that, you know, like the government's cracking down. But look, like, they don't know what they're doing. If they knew what they were doing, if they knew what was going on, they wouldn't be selling the Bitcoin. If the grand plan is to crush Bitcoin, you don't sell your spot Bitcoin in an auction back to people who are going to hold it for another 100 years. Like, there's no long term, like, well thought out plan to crush Bitcoin from the government. They're going to be very reactive about it. Mm-hmm. We give them a lot more credit than I think they deserve. And I think, like, you know, the strategies are they're just silly, right? And you're gonna have some deep state people, but, you know, there's no long term plan. I think everyone's just underestimating it all the time. They'll continue to underestimate it until it's too late, and then they'll start throwing the guns and the weapons up. That's my take on it. But I don't think that happens till after it passes gold. Like, then that's when there's going to be a bloodbath. Will be then, not before.
So we'll piece this all together. You actually, though, have answered my final question. My final question was, like, predictions over the next 12 to 18 months. I'm happy to hear, like, price predictions, but you've given me a lot to think about in terms of, you know, overall adoption in the coming years. What do you think, or anything you're excited about, or any particular predictions you have in the shorter term?
12 to 18 months.
Hopefully they get, you know, Lightning fixed. Yeah. Because the thing is, 2 days ago, we went out. 2 days? Yeah, 2 days ago. We've actually I personally have never had this problem with Lightning. But I don't know why, but it was very hard to transfer and send Bitcoin from different types of Lightning wallets. Let's say Strike and GetAlvi, they wouldn't send to each other. Or, you know, Coinos to Blink.
There's different node software for Lightning nodes, and I think one of them that Coinos was using was not, you know, willing to open channels with, like, the cost of fees. And so a lot of the other wallets, which kind of needed to open channels to Coinos, like, they just couldn't open them because of that. I could be wrong. Adam explained it pretty well, but yeah, I don't know. Like, I have never had problems with Lightning until the day we were going to survive on it. You know, but look, I don't know enough about this stuff to say definitively, like, whether Lightning's going to fail or succeed. I think if I was to make a prediction for this year, I think you're finally going to see some more merchants get on board. That whole thing with Square saying, oh, now you can put a chunk of your, you know, your sales into Bitcoin. I think small businesses will take that up, but I think you'll start to see more jump on the whole, like, treasury strategy bandwagon, because now you have this FASB accounting thing, which went under the rug. But, you know, Tesla's still holding their Bitcoin. They're up massively on their position. MicroStrategy is doing what MicroStrategy does. But, you know, it's a good way to do something with your treasury. I don't think it's going to be like an Apple or a Microsoft or an Amazon, but I wouldn't be surprised if, like, one of these smaller cloud companies, think of like a Roku or a, you know, a Cloudflare, one of these type of companies, I think will start a Bitcoin strategy in the next 12 to 18 months.
I like that prediction. I hope you're right. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I've taken a bit more of your time than anticipated. We had several disconnections. Yeah, I think it's just an adventure with you guys. That's just what you're in for if you hang out with Julian and Isabella. So,
yeah. And Adam, he'll be here next time.
I need to chat with him. He probably has some interesting things to talk about.
Here's the thing. Adam actually has, like, a real job and a real business and shareholders. Yeah. Like, we're just fucking around here. We're just like the fucking around crew. He just wants to have his name on it.
Hey, it takes all kinds of.
Yeah, he's got actual responsibilities. We're just trying to entertain people.
Well, I'll look forward to hopefully connecting with him as well. So thank you guys so much for the time today.
He's the OG. He's the original gangster.
Yeah,
he's the OG.
Yeah.
I love it.
Court certified.
He's teaching us his ways.
Court certified OG. They asked him in court.
Court certified.
Yeah, they asked him in court on the record what he meant when he described himself as an OG Bitcoiner, and he said, it means original gangster. So
that is great. I love that.
That's how you describe Adam. Awesome. Legit original gangster. In life and in Bitcoin.
OG.
I can't wait to talk to him then. You guys are going to have to introduce me. Thank you guys so much though. Yeah. Seriously, this has been so much fun. Hey, give a quick handoff. Where can people find you, follow you, keep up with what you're doing?
Base TV, YouTube, Twitter. Yeah. We're not on Instagram yet, but we'll figure that out. But yeah, YouTube and Twitter, at Catbase TV. We have shows coming out every single freaking week now. No more Once in a Blue Moon documentaries. Those are once a month. Her shows every 2 weeks. Adam's shows every week. My shorts are twice a week. We're going to rev that schedule up by the end of this year as well. So, yeah, if you want to stay in touch with us, you can just follow us.
Love
Thank
to
you
hear
so
it.
Much for having us.
Yeah, you guys are rock stars. Keep it up. Love your work.
You too. Keep it up.
Thank you, guys. Cheers.
Thanks, man.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Isabella and Julian as much as I did. They are a lot of fun, great energy, and I think they're doing some really, really important and good things for Bitcoin. If this, I'm guessing that once this podcast comes out, their documentary will also be out. So make sure you look at that. Follow them on YouTube. Check out their shorts. They post all over Twitter and sort of the usual places. They gave you the handoff, of course. And if you need help with self-custody, don't forget to reach out to The Bitcoin Way. It's thebitcoinway.com. You can follow us on X. It's at @thebitcoinway_. And for me personally, if you want to connect, follow me on X. It's at @theothermjordan. And I've got a personal newsletter, blackhatbitcoin.substack.com, where I just talk about very basics of Bitcoin, give some analogies to help explain it to normies, newcomers to Bitcoin, and so forth. As always, I appreciate you being here. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.